Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, a program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. A woman I have admired from afar for a long time is our first guest. I'm very pleased to say we've been anxious to have her on for some time as well, and are very, very pleased that she was able to find a few minutes for us in the midst of a lot of drama in Washington, D.C. As we speak, the House is poised to consider a $1.2 trillion minibus appropriations, and we'll talk a little bit about some of what's in there, with Victoria Spartz. She is the representative of the people of the 5th District of Indiana. She has a background in finance and business. She is what I call a foreign-born American patriot, hailing from Ukraine. We're going to talk with her a little bit about Ukraine, too. But first, let me welcome you, Congresswoman. It's such a pleasure to have you with us, and thank you for your service to our country and the Congress of the United States.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let me start by asking you about a subject that I heard you were getting engaged in and couldn't be more pleased. As you may know, one of the things that we support here is the Committee on the Present Danger, China. And we've been working for 5 years now with a mutual friend of ours, Roger Robinson, to call attention to the exploitation by the Chinese Communist Party and its friends, notably on Wall Street, to finance the threat that we now face from China on our own capital markets. Tell us what you make of that and what you're trying to do about it.
Well, listen, this is, Frank, it's a very serious national security issue because everything is about the money. And when we are going to have no transparency and have our investors, our pension plan be invested to help, you know, Chinese Communist Party to finance the military that they tried, you know, to use to take over the world, we're in trouble. We have to have transparency. And the biggest problem we have, a lot of people don't realize, I used to be an auditor, Big Four auditor, and I did quality control inspections of audits. I was shocked to see that the only country that was exempt to do quality control was China. I said, are you kidding me? Communist country with so many operations, unfortunately, that were incentivized to move, you know, to China and destroy American jobs. Now we have a serious dependency on the communist country, which is really a huge national security problem. You know, we actually don't even audit. And I can tell you, the books are cooked there. I don't even have to go do that. So that was really sad for me to see. But their presence on our markets without people to listen, if you want to invest in a communist country, go ahead and do it. But what we're doing right now, we have Americans, you know, hardworking Americans that in their savings put at risk, you know, to actually invest in our adversaries. This is unacceptable. 100%. And I think we need to start dealing with it.
Yeah. As you may know, Congressman, if you haven't gotten it, we'll get a copy for you. But we wrote a book last year based in no small measure on the work that we've been doing with the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and Roger Robinson and others. It's entitled The Indictment, Prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World. And featured in that, stand by, sorry. I've been on the we've been taping for too long. I had to put another quarter in the machine. Sorry, let me just start that over again. We've been working assiduously on this issue for quite some time, including with our book, The Indictment, Prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and Friends for Crimes Against America, China, and the World. And a centerpiece of that is exactly the point you've just made. Our friend Roger Robinson and our Committee on the Present Danger of China have been fixed on the essentially pass that has been given to the Chinese by our government going back to the Biden role in the Obama-Biden administration in May of 2013. This is a travesty. And I'm so grateful that you've been focused on it and that you are now going to be trying with legislation to rectify the problem. Talk a little bit about your initiatives, if you would.
Yeah, we're just actually, I'm a co-chair of CPA caucus, and I'm glad to see that my co-chair is, you know, that he's agreeing with me on this issue. And there are a lot of issues that are very, very partisan, but that shouldn't be a partisan issue. This is a serious national security issue. China infiltrated our supply chains, our data, and our financial markets. It's a huge danger to our country. So what we need to do, we actually introduce a package of bills where we're going to say, you know, if you're going to be investing in our adversaries, you should not have a preferential treatment on your capital gains. You know, we do the preferential treatments when you want to invest in America and create American jobs. But when you invest in the adversary, you shouldn't get a capital gain rate. We also need to have a transparency, so we know what corporations, you know, when you invest in some stocks and corporations, you know, and how they address the risk, because it's a huge risk. So it needs to be transparency of their Chinese operations, because it's a significant risk to supply chain and investors. And we have to protect our public interest in financial markets. We also need to see what is happening with the indices. You know, they infiltrated now a lot of index funds, and which is really becoming a problem that people don't even realize, you know, that they invest in Chinese Communist Party in their 401ks or pensions. And I think we have to make sure that we'll start enforcing and including sanctions. You know, if you're going to have, you know, we have a very bad mechanism enforcement of sanctions. We go there and talk about, we're going to deal with these adversaries. We create so many loopholes that we right now have pretty much China, Iran, and Russia, you know, teamed up and, you know, still, you know, selling oil and trading like there is nothing happened. I think we need to put stop for it.
Right. You're so right. And I'm really, all I can say is praise the Lord that you are aware of and trying to address the lack of transparency, because I think you're absolutely right. The vast majority of people whose life savings are now being poured into Chinese companies that are in some cases directly supporting the Chinese military or, you know, the repression of the people of China there in the mainland, have their 401k plans and so on invested in this fashion. Tell me a little bit, if you would, about what is going to be done if you are successful. And is Brad Sherman your counterpart on the Democratic side? He's a big player in all of this, obviously. To insist that these entities that are friends of China, if you will, on Wall Street notably, are held accountable for this kind of really non-transparent sluicing of our money to support our mortal enemy.
Yeah, I think we need to stop catering to Wall Street at the expense of Main Street. And unfortunately, Washington, D.C. does so much talk, you know, yeah, we're fighting China and, you know, on TV, but really not put it into action. So if we're serious and we truly have a serious problem, that we, you know, we're going to send a letter to my colleagues and we start putting pressure on leadership of both parties, not just do the talk, but do the work, because this is serious issues. And we need to make sure that we start mitigating this risk and really start really putting companies, you know, how, you know, on the spot, how they're going to address this risk. Because if not, then what are we going to have again? Too big to fail? Bailouts? Or what are we going to do? But I think it's also a danger to our economy to have such dependencies. Truly is. And we saw that during the pandemic, what China was doing, how they were manipulated supply chain on purpose to cause us a lot of headaches and problems and inflation and everything else. This is being dependent on one country, you know, 80% of supply chain, it is really a problem. But communist country, we know that every company there is working for communist government. We know that very well.
100%. And that communist country actually has as its stated purpose, taking us down. That's another problem too. Congressman Victoria Spartz, hold on if you would. We'll be right back with more on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Notwithstanding prescient warnings from American intelligence weeks ago, a murderous attack was successfully perpetrated by an Islamic State franchise on participants at a weekend concert in Russia. The question occurs, since FBI Director Christopher Wray has lately repeatedly warned America faces heightened risks of terrorism emanating from Afghanistan as well as Chinese-sponsored cyber attacks, are we any better prepared to prevent them? Don't count on it. In fact, we face the prospect of not just a handful of perpetrators that just killed over 130 in Moscow, or nearly 3,000 here on 9/11. Thanks to the Biden administration's effective destruction of our southern border, there are believed conservatively to be tens of thousands of jihadists and Chinese military personnel inside the United States today. Every effort must now be made to find, remove, or otherwise neutralize such clear and present dangers. This is Frank Afton. Welcome back. We're visiting with a woman I admire greatly, Congresswoman Victoria Spartz of Indiana. We've been talking with her a little bit about the support we are unwittingly, many of us, giving to our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. It happens also to be engaged in what I call strategic arson around the world, part of which has been manifested in its No Limits partnership with Vladimir Putin's Russia, to attack Ukraine and wage merciless war against its people. Victoria Spartz hails from Ukraine. Congressman, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts. I know you have been a strong supporter of standing up to Putin. You've also warned that we're not doing a very good job of that under Joe Biden. Talk us through the policy that you think needs to be pursued vis-a-vis Putin and, well, his masters, I would argue, in Beijing, led by Xi Jinping.
For sure. Listen, I mean, unfortunately, we forgot that peace can only be through strength, and our adversaries will use any weaknesses. And this president, unfortunately, being so political and weak, and what's happening in Afghanistan, it was a total embarrassment and how he did that. And emboldened, you know, people like Putin, he, you know, under Trump, he was afraid of him and he didn't move. And under Biden, he understood this is the time to move. Biden has terrible energy policies. He's afraid of everything and everyone, appeasing, you know, China, appeasing Iran, that is pretty much getting nuclear weapons. I mean, this is a serious problem. This is the same Obama people now running the country that really let Putin to go in Crimea and Eastern Ukraine was doing nothing after Ukraine gave up, you know, nuclear weapons with assurances of territorial integrity. So he understood he can move and he will go as far as, you know, he can go. And China is watching too, and they're watching how they're going to learn from mistakes of Ukraine if they go after Taiwan. It was interesting because I had an intern in my office who could actually speak Chinese, and she was sharing some interesting things what's happening in social media and China, and that's a discussion they have, how they can do much faster, you know, what they need to do to take over Taiwan, which would be a serious, serious problem for all of us too. So, and we obviously could see that before the war started, Putin went to his king, get a permission, you know, to attack and then move, and in exchange to help him with all what he's doing, and they issued a statement. They want to redefine the world. They want to come after us. It was a very open statement they did in February of 22. And ultimately, you know, we're the only obstacle for them to take over the world, and we really need to become more vigilant and smarter.
You said that so well and so succinctly. Let me ask you, in terms of the practical implications of what you've just said. I'm a big believer in peace through strength. I had the privilege of working for the man who basically promulgated that as his national strategy, Ronald Reagan. What does that mean as you see it now in Ukraine? Many in the Republican caucus, as you know so well, are now refusing to contemplate any further U.S. assistance. Is that what you are recommending, or do you think that we've given what we can and other means need to be brought to bear to try to help the people of Ukraine?
It's unfortunately that we kind of have now like a monopoly of narratives, and sometimes with some issue, I feel like it's really strange for me. We either have a position or Ukraine doesn't matter, which on the national security front, it does matter and what's happening is significant, or we have, you know, oh, we can just have, should have blank checks. No, we should never have blank checks. We do not want to have never-ending war. We want to do not as long as it takes, but as fast as we can, have proper oversight and strategy. And it only comes with, you know, deterrencies. You know, we didn't supply weapons to Ukraine before Putin got in. We didn't really do sanctions before. We didn't create deterrencies. We slow walked the aid. This president, you know, didn't really send a strong message. So Putin got emboldened and have a very serious situation right now. This, you know, people only understand the language of weapons. If you want to get them to the table, you know, and have a conversation about peace, you have to have weapons enough that they know that they're going to lose. That's how they're going to get to the table. Otherwise, they will be advancing further and further. And that is unfortunate reality when we deal with aggressors like that. They have ambitions, they have really vendettas, and cannot get over that Soviet Union fell apart and want to rebuild that. And because, and they think it's because of us. So we need to be smarter. But I just haven't seen this president. It's almost impossible. I try. We try to push him, and sometimes on bipartisan basis. But honestly, I almost gave up on him right now. We just need to figure out how we can hold their ground. And also how probably, you know, I was actually a big supporter to loan instead of providing, you know, money to Ukraine as a blank check, because they have a lot of problems, a lot of corruptions. You have very brave people fighting in the trenches, but governments infiltrating political, it's a really big problem in a lot of these countries, and we should learn from mistakes of Afghanistan and Iraq.
So just very quickly, a minute or so, if you could, you are in favor of continuing to provide arms to Ukraine, perhaps on a lend base rather than, the actual provision of them from the American taxpayer, but that you're under no illusion that if Putin is not stopped in Ukraine, that he may attack elsewhere?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he will go as far as he can go. That's ultimately his desire, and he will continue to stabilize. And he also doing a lot of hybrid wars. He's spending a lot of money because we didn't even put sanction on his oil. You know, I mean, it's really, that's where the blood money are and how he finances it now. And does it help Iran with that stuff too? They teamed up in China. So I think we need to make sure the sanctions enforce better. We do like lethal aid. We loaned it because Ukraine should pay us back, and we need to have accountability from them and do faster and better lethal aid, not just doing slush funds that we've been doing where only 10 to 20% of money actually goes directly, you know, to the front line. The rest of it is like billion to Yemen. Seriously, to Houthis in Yemen, it's just give from Ukrainian aid, and now they're attacking our ships. It's just disgrace.
Yeah, they are indeed, and they will sink one of them, I'm afraid, in the near future. Congressman, let me shift gears if I can. Your clarity about China is so appreciated, not just, you know, what it's doing with our money, not just what it's doing with its proxies. And that strategic arson idea really feeds into this notion that ultimately Ukraine, Israel, Red Sea, perhaps other places are in the service of their agenda vis-a-vis Taiwan and us. I wanted to ask you about another line of attack that the Chinese are using at the moment. It's a strategy they call global governance. The World Health Organization is kind of the pointy end of the spear on this idea. They hope in just 65 days, 64 days or so, to have not one but two agreements, really treaties, that will empower the Director General of the World Health Organization to become the arbiter of public health emergencies in this country and what we must do about them. What are your thoughts about this? As we speak, there's this appropriations bill that I mentioned that would give the funding that the WHO wants to proceed in this direction. Should we be making that funding available in your estimation?
Well, listen, this is a terrible, you know, terrible situation, terrible idea. We need to understand that China, Russia, and this kind of, they infiltrated all of this international organization, World Health Organization, UN, they're all controlled by people that are accountable to their government. And their goal is to buy some corrupt governments in other countries. If you notice, China gives loans to a lot of countries, and then Russia sends Wagner Group to support corrupt governments. You know, that's how they took over, you know, Africa and do it in a lot of other regions. You know, that is a strategy that's working. And they took over this international organization, and their goal, they never follow. Look at the World Health Organization. What happened was when we had a whistleblower in China who actually was, you know, disappeared somewhere, you know, and talking about this pandemic that and leak what's happened, whatever, on purpose or on purpose. But where was investigations? What happened to him? No one even knows. Who actually did World Health Organization did something? No. This, look at this communist countries.
And what they did to
never
us
do anything.
In this
yeah,
pandemic.
But what they're going to do, they're going to try to use, you know, to destroy and undermine, you know, our national security. And we need to be very, we cannot be stupid.
Can't let this happen. Congresswoman, I hate to cut you off. We are out of time. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your service to our country, your adopted country. God bless you. Keep up the great work. Come back to us soon if you would. I hope the
Thank
rest
you.
Of you will
Thank
stay
you.
Tuned. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. It's time for one of my favorite segments in this program, and that is one dedicated to our Save the Persecuted Christians agenda. And we have a very special presentation for you today, and I'm going to simply turn it over to my co-host for this segment, Didi Logason, the Executive Director of Save the Persecuted Christians, to introduce our special guest. Didi, welcome back.
Hi there, Frank. Always good to be here. Yeah, so I got finished with my work yesterday and came across a post asking for prayers for Israel and for Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Washington, D.C. As of yesterday, that was supposed to be today, but our guest, Pam Pryor, Executive Director of Communication at Cornerstone Chapel in Arlington, Virginia, and former Acting Assistant Secretary for International Organization Affairs at U.S. State, has some news for us today about Benjamin Netanyahu's visit and what's being cooked up for him. Pam, tell us about the visit and all the shenanigans going on behind the scenes.
Shenanigans is such a nice safe word, isn't it? Oh, well, thank you, Didi. Thank you, Frank. Always good to be with you all, too, and admire your work on so many levels. This even has, I know we're going to talk about persecuted Christians, but this even has a little bit of a Chinese gloss on it. And this is the fact that there is a meeting that is scheduled with Benjamin Netanyahu in the White House with Secretary Blinken. My understanding, it's been pushed off for a week. I think that's probably because we heard about this on Wednesday. The meeting got changed on Thursday, and I never underestimate the power of prayer. So I think we could have maybe kicked this down the road, give more people time to pray. But here's the thing. It was brought to us by a person working at the State Department, and I want to be very careful because of the retribution that can come because of people that tip us off to things that they are coming for a meeting, and I'm going to be looking at my notes because I want to be specific on this. So you're going to see my eyes look a little bit weird here, but it's about the security situation in Gaza and anticipated operations in Gaza, whether that's the dock that they're building, the ill-placed dock the floating dock. But very recently, and this is the problem, the Biden administration changed its approach to security assistance. This is outside the Senate. This is outside the House. They changed recipients had to certify that none of the assistance was being used to commit human rights violations. This is above and beyond Leahy vetting. By the way, Leahy vetting is a good thing. This is like you can't give money to somebody that's going to turn around and use it against their own people. So this is a good thing. We're not against Leahy vetting, but this is Leahy vetting has been taking place for years, came through the Senate, and applies to countries, not organizations like UNRWA, which, you know, is operating in Gaza. But there are growing vocal factions within the State Department that are anti-Israel and advocating for a cessation or severe curtailment of such assistance to Israel. And the determination about the future of that assistance is currently in a memo at the Secretary Blinken's desk. And so here are the options, and there's probably some other, but just four quick options. They can assess Israel as being in compliance and approve further assistance, which, by the way, the ambassador in Israel has said that's a good thing to do. They could assess Israel as not being in compliance. That's the position of a lot of the bureaus within the State Department, and then stop all assistance. They could grant a waiver or do nothing, in which case the assistance would continue. So Netanyahu felt like this was important enough that he's coming over with some of his war deputies to specifically speak to these issues. They are not in human rights violation. I mean, anybody that read, and by the way, I don't even suggest you do this, but you read even the New York Times account of what happened on August 7th. It's a memory. October 7th of the first the terrorist attack by Hamas. It gets seared in your memory, and it's hard to even forget the horrific things that happened. But these are people defending themselves. This is looking out for the sovereignty of a country. And let me just go one step further. Another complicating factor here, Didi, as they are persecuting Christians, they're persecuting our fellow citizens in Israel, is the fact that China on TikTok, anytime somebody's looking for information on like pictures in Israel or some of the fighting or even what I referred to on October 7th, they are making it 90 to 95% be pro-Hamas. So it's being served up all the time to our young people, 170 million TikTok users in the US. So anyway, a lot to pray over.
Yeah, but and we just heard last week that 74% or so of American youth and young adults are getting their daily news from TikTok, from the propaganda being promoted by the CCP through this platform to the younger Americans. That's how they're getting their news. And we've seen this incredible massive uptick of anti-Semitism in the pro-Hamas rallies and protests, and they're not quiet about it. And the colleges as well, it just exploded across the United States. I think so many of us were just shocked by that. But really, isn't the United States an ally of Israel? It doesn't seem like the Biden administration is being very friendly to Israel right now.
Well, we're one of their only allies, and that's the problem. You know, We've seen some assistance come, but yes, we are friends. We have been friends forever, and woe to us if we break our friendship with Israel. I mean, Scripture tells us to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, and we must do that. And Didi, one thing I would direct people there. My pastor did a fabulous sermon called Israel, Hamas, and the End Times. If you go to cornerstonechapel.net, you can scroll through the archives and find that. What we're talking about is not a war against flesh and blood. It's enacted through flesh and blood, but this is spiritual proportions. And, you know, even the things, the blinding of our youth, and them believing lies. That's spiritual warfare, and we need to pray against this. We need to claim that no weapon formed will prosper, but we need to put on our shields and really fight for what we know is right in Israel.
Right, and that meeting was supposed to take...
Could I just inject one point on this? Because it seems to me, to your larger observation, that we're not supporting Israel as an ally must, especially when they're fighting our fight as well as their own. But there's a report out that the Biden administration has not only created, you mentioned it, this, or is in the process of creating this temporary port. That it looks as though it could be used not only to insert a lot of stuff that will help save Hamas, but also possibly exfiltrate large numbers of Palestinian so-called refugees to bring them here, probably without our knowledge, subversively as well as covertly. But Pam, there's a report that Samantha Power, and I think you know her, having worked in the government for a while, now the USAID director of the Agency for International Development, has actually turned over the management responsibilities for this so-called port to the Qataris, but worse yet, to a company that is owned by Hamas. How could this possibly be done? And can the Israelis live with this arrangement?
Well, hopefully when Mr. Netanyahu comes to America, maybe he'll have some choice words for that. I mean, but, you know, Frank, it is unthinkable. On the other hand, I am so thrilled that this stuff is coming to light. Have you ever seen a time when, I'm going to borrow a phrase from some of our prophetic arm of our faith, a shaking of God, just shaking things out and saying, look what's here, look what's here. So I'm glad that we know that. And Frank, to your point, this is not just about Israel. We know that the proxies, the Iran proxies, it's not just about Israel. They're coming after us too. And by the way, if you want to import Palestinian refugees, all they need to do is go to Mexico and cross the border. You know, they'll be welcomed with open arms. So,
this is a way of getting them out of this area.
Will Benjamin Netanyahu be welcomed here? Will he be welcomed by what's happening from conservatives? Are they going to welcome Netanyahu?
Well, you would hope so. I mean, Representative Tlaib, I know Speaker Johnson's talking about having a joint session. It would be very interesting to see what happened in that, because you saw during the State of the Union a couple of them sporting the Hamas colors and you know, Palestinian flag and signs, stop the bombs and all this. And you know, this really is about the sovereignty of Israel too, and Frank, back to your statement, our own sovereignty.
The survival of Israel, I think it's beyond sovereignty. And Didi, I might disagree with you about this. I think we need Benjamin Netanyahu's voice to be heard in this country for sure. But I think for the reasons that Pam's just talked about, the idea of putting him in a place that will almost certainly be politically not just charged, but, bedlam. Is probably,
you know, send him into the fiery furnace, the right?
Well, indeed, the pits of hell. We have to leave it at that. Pam Pryor, thank you for your service to our country over so many years in so many different ways. And I think that you are rendering at Cornerstone Chapel, one of my favorite institutions of
privilege
of faith,
to be there, Frank. It's a special, very different than the State Department.
A special blessing, yes, indeed. From purgatory into something approximating heaven. God bless you. Keep up the great work. Didi, thank you for yours at Save the Persecuted Christians as well. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll be right back with more, folks. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Notwithstanding prescient warnings from American intelligence weeks ago, a murderous attack was successfully perpetrated by an Islamic State franchise on participants at a weekend concert in Russia. The question occurs, since FBI Director Christopher Wray has lately repeatedly warned America faces heightened risks of terrorism emanating from Afghanistan as well as Chinese-sponsored cyber attacks, are we any better prepared to prevent them? Don't count on it.
In fact, we face the prospect of not just a handful of perpetrators that just killed over 130 in Moscow, or nearly 3,000 here on 9/11. Thanks to the Biden administration's effective destruction of our southern border, there are believed conservatively to be tens of thousands of jihadists and Chinese military personnel inside the United States today. Every effort must now be made to find, remove, or otherwise neutralize such clear and present dangers. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and Sam Faddis is in the house. This is one of the high points of our week. He is a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned, a man who has distinguished himself in government service, both in the uniform of the United States Army, as well as without a uniform, as an undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years. These days, he is providing an incalculable service to our country still in his role as the driving force behind a wonderful online resource and magazine, which you can find at substack.com. Sam, thank you so much for taking time each week with us. This is, as I say, a very important moment to be taking stock of where we are, and there's nobody I prefer to do it with more than with you. Welcome.
As always, thank you for having me, Frank.
Thank you. Let's start with a proposition that I put forward in a commentary today, hearkening back to a figure who gained prominence with heroic generaling in the Revolutionary War, up to the point at which he decided that he had been badly treated by George Washington and company, and he was going to essentially betray his nascent country and actually enable the Brits to capture George Washington, which would probably have snuffed the whole thing if it had been successful. His name was Benedict Arnold, and it has been a name that has become associated with treachery, yes, but treason as well over the years. Sam, in the course of our conversations, week upon week upon week, documenting what the Biden administration is doing, I think it's time to describe Joe Biden as Benedict Biden. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the aptness of that expression.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you have, I think you've put your finger on the essence of the situation in regard to Joe Biden, and something that most people seem to either miss or deliberately decide not to discuss, right? We can talk about what shoes he's wearing and whether he fell on the steps and dementia, and we can even talk about Hunter and his penchant for hookers and blow. And I guess if you're really pushing the envelope, you can talk about the fact that maybe Joe did some favors for some people and got some money in his pocket. What apparently you can't talk about it is the essence of this thing, which is where the money was coming from, what would have been expected in return, and then look at the man's record in 3 years, step by step by step, and whose interest is it in and whose interest is it against?
Right. So let's drill down on that a little bit. And I think you've, as usual, said it extremely well. Where did a substantial amount of the money come from? And who did it serve as it was provided to the Biden family, including Joe?
Well, obviously, there is a long list of thugs around the planet who gave money to the Bidens. At the top of that list, by far, are the Chinese, meaning the Chinese Communist Party. And we look at the folks, these specific individuals, people like Patrick Ho, that handed the money to Joe, or to Hunter for Joe, but in some cases met with Joe. These are folks, these are Chinese intelligence officers and individuals tied directly to Chinese intelligence. So Chinese intelligence, Chinese Communist Party handing money to the Bidens.
And when you say that it's Chinese intelligence, I mean, is there really any disputing that point?
No, there's no dispute. I mean, I always come back to, just as the most concrete example, I think the easiest for folks who don't want to get lost in the inside baseball aspect of this is, who's the primary contact with the top? CEFC China Energy, which is a Chinese Intel front company, is the entity with which the Bidens are dealing most of the time. Their number one point of contact, their man on the ground in the United States, is Patrick Ho. Okay. The FBI investigated Ho. The DOJ prosecuted Ho for buying foreign officials on U.S. soil at precisely the same time that Ho was doing with those officials exactly what he was doing with the Bidens. So the FBI looked at this, caught him red-handed, established conclusively who he was and what he was doing, and put him in prison for doing it, and then simultaneously looked at him doing exactly the same thing with the Bidens and just walked on.
Yeah. So this is just one of the myriad examples we've discussed over the years of the FBI not doing its job. But to the extent that he was getting money from Chinese intelligence, and I think Byron Donalds has done a very interesting service in terms of connecting dots in terms of the passing of the money from Chinese sources to Joe Biden personally. Mm-hmm. But talk a little bit about cui bono, you know, the benefit that the Chinese have received from what's been done here.
Well, as I think I've said to you before, if we just start at the time that the man sits down in the Oval Office to today, I would defy you to find a single instance on which he has confronted a decision and made a choice which was detrimental to Beijing and beneficial to us, starting with draining the strategic oil reserve, waging jihad on our fossil fuel industry, turning Afghanistan over to the Taliban, who have brought the Chinese into Bagram Air Base. I mean, step by step by step, every point, the border, I mean, 100,000 Americans a year die from fentanyl poisoning. All the precursor chemicals come out of China. No, folks, they don't smuggle that past the Chinese, the PLA Navy, and somehow get it here. That is all done with the approval, cooperation of the Chinese Communist Party. So these guys are waging a chemical warfare attack on us and killing 100,000 Americans.
They are.
And we don't do anything.
That unpleasantness about the biological warfare attack that you've been tracking so
closely. There you go.
Sam, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the enemy within problem and how that is bearing on the dangers that we face from the Chinese Communist Party, among many others, under Benedict Biden's regime. Stay tuned. We're back, and we're continuing one of the most important conversations I think we've had on this program since its inception with Sam Faddis, Charles Sam Faddis, as he is known officially. He is a man of distinction in a number of public service roles, including that of an undercover operative for our Central Intelligence Agency. He knows a thing or two about discerning enemies and trying to counter them, especially when they are operating inside government. And Sam, it's drawing upon all of that I want to speak to you about our next topic, which is, well, I think it can be described broadly as part of the enemy within problem. We discussed a little bit about Benedict Biden, the President of the United States, and what he has been doing. I wanted to talk with you about a phenomenon that one of our colleagues, Ji Van Fleet, was on the program the other day discussing, and that is the cultural warfare that is being waged against our country in a very Maoist line of attack by, yes, the Chinese Communist Party to some extent, but most especially by Marxists here, including inside our government. You did a brilliant piece at N Magazine at Substack the other day about this phenomenon of diversity, equity, inclusion being manifested within the intelligence community of the United States and the unbelievably deleterious effects that that is having. Talk a little bit about that, both in its own right and kind of as a microcosm of what the Biden Marxists are doing more broadly.
So I think people are generally aware of this idea that there's diversity, equity, and inclusion, and it has infiltrated the federal government, right? So using the IC as an example, you have a diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI office in every agency, and then you got a big umbrella such office at the level of the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. Okay, and these guys spew this crazy newspeak, groupthink, Marxist ideology and tell you what pronouns you should use and how you should speak. So people, I think, are generally aware of that. What I don't think they're aware of is that this is not like these guys are sitting off in the corner babbling and you can just make fun of them and ignore them and continue to do your job. I mean, this is really where the rubber meets the road. You can't do that, because if you do, there will be consequences. You'll be fired. You certainly won't get promoted. There are teeth here behind this whole thing. So what we were talking about in AM Magazine the other day is that there is a publication now that is put out, I think it's now quarterly. It's called The Dive or something, as if it's a deep dive from the level of the Director of National Intelligence from that DEI office. And it prescribes, it lays out things you can and cannot say. So for instance, on Islamic extremism, if you're working against Islamic terrorist organizations, you can't call them jihadists anymore. That's a derogatory term. It's also insane to say that, right? As you and I both know, these guys call themselves jihadists. In fact, if they're not on jihad, it is in fact the fact that they are waging jihad that guarantees they will go to paradise when they die touching off their suicide vest. But so they use the term, but you can't, because it is derogatory. You also can't refer to them as Islamic extremists, even though they're fighting an expressly religious war, and the whole issue is that they're Muslims and you're not, in their view.
So Sam, this is crazy. How are you supposed to describe Islamic jihadist extremists?
You know, they came up with a term, I think it's Qawarji, something like that, which that some bizarre, some imam I never heard of told them. I worked Islamic extremism for a long time, never heard that term. I no idea where they came up with that.
It's not English, I take it. It's
no, it's it allegedly is an Arabic term used by somebody, but it's fascinating that in decades of working the target, I've never heard this term.
Right, especially from the target set. So Sam, I mean, let's just explicate, what are the implications of not actually properly identifying, let alone characterizing, the nature of the enemy that we confront? And this is, again, just one example. And in fairness, you can find its predecessors during, I think, Obama 1.0 and 2.0, if not actually during the Bush administrations, after 9/11. But as a guy whose job it is, or has been, to know the enemy so that you can effectively counter it, is this a victory at, you know, our expense by the jihadis in the information warfare space? And what are the knock-on effects as you see it?
Well, without question. And look, there are at least two different effects here. One is, so we're not really going to talk about the issue. We're going to dance around it. We're not going to characterize these people. I mean, these people are waging an expressly religious war. They believe it's this is the apocalypse. This is Armageddon. Okay, we know that. That's what it's all about. But we're not going to talk about that. We can't talk about that. So we, even if we wanted to, we can't begin to really grapple with the enemy. But secondly, understand internally in a bureaucratic sense, this means the operator who actually wants to go confront the target and speak truth and get down to the matter at hand is going to be shoved aside in favor of the person who probably can't do their job, but what they can do is they can mouth these words, right? I mean, in World War II, one of the prices Stalin paid early on in 1941 was the Germans came across the border and he had spent all his time purging all the guys who knew how to fight a war in place of people who would say the right things. And a whole bunch of people died as a consequence.
Stalingrad, right. So are we facing, in your professional judgment, the possibility of a similar decisive defeat at the hands of people we cannot name and who are very clear about their purpose, which is to destroy the infidel, to force submission to their caliphate, and otherwise make over the world to their liking. I mean, is that where we are? And by the way, I'm assuming that there are similar kinds of blinders being put on the intelligence community about the Chinese. Because obviously there's a lot of xenophobia around here. Can't have that, can we? But Sam, just from an operational point of view, you've been in the belly of this beast. You've written a book about the CIA called Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Is this essentially putting us at peril because our intelligence agencies are completely unable to do their job?
Yeah, without question. What it means, when you add all this up, what it means is you're blind. It means that nobody's recruiting any sources inside Al-Qaeda and nobody's giving you the intelligence you need.
Including those liaison services that we've relied upon, like Pakistan's intelligence service?
Yeah. Mm. Those guys that are one step away from finding the insurgents in Islamabad, raising the flag.
Right. Sam, there's so much more to talk about all of this. Unfortunately, we are at the end of our time with you today, but I just want you to know how much I appreciate the clarity, the integrity, and the courage that you exhibit here, of course, but with your very, very important output at andmagazine.com at Substack. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us next week, if you would. Hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.